I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object.
I watched a snail crawl along the edge of a straight razor. That's my dream. It's my nightmare. Crawling, slithering along the edge of a straight razor and surviving.
We are living on the front lines of a war zone, and the fate of the planet may very well be at stake. So argues Counterpunch's Jeffrey St. Clair and Joshua Frank in the new book, The Big Heat, Earth on the Brink. On this edition of Parallax Views, Joshua Frank joins us to discuss the book. As we find ourselves hurling towards the probability of climate catastrophe, continued destruction of wildlife, and an environmental nightmare. Welcome to the war zone, comrades. Welcome to Parallax Views, Joshua Frank.
Thanks for having me.
So, Joshua, you're one of the head honchos, along with Jeffrey St. Clair over at the great website Counterpunch. And you guys have a new book out called The Big Heat, Earth on the Brink. Could you tell my listeners a little bit about what that means? What do you mean by the Earth on the Brink? Of course, we know about climate change, but I think sometimes people don't understand the severity of the situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, you know, I think we, a lot of us, you know, we see the reports of the climate warming. We know the oceans are warming. We know climate change is happening. We understand the esoteric nature of climate catastrophe. But really what we want to approach in the book was, how is this sort of looking on the ground, on the day-to-day, the people that are living it? You know, all of us are in some capacity, and some of us more than others are experiencing it firsthand. So we kind of wanted to get a firsthand take. And Earth on the Brink, I think, really try to signify what the next chapter might be for our little blue planet, because it could definitely go in multiple directions, and we don't necessarily know what that's going to be. We have, you know, we have all these computer models, and we have other things that kind of try to guesstimate the severity of the catastrophe at hand, but no one really knows. It's a gamble. But what we do know is it is changing, and we know that humans are largely responsible. So we try to address in multiple factors in the book, not only, you know, taking on the fossil fuel industry, but also putting a spotlight on a lot of the organizations and groups of people that are fighting back. And in the end, I think we really wanted to just to portray the environmental movement as a movement that needs to be structured in a way that will challenge everybody, no matter, you know, what political party they might be in. And it's really a call to action at the grassroots level as well.
Well, you know, it leads me to an interesting point that I wanted to sort of ask you about. For me, I think a lot of times when people talk about climate change or just environmental issues as a whole, I think in a lot of ways, a lot of journalists and a lot of academics have failed to really convey these things to the public. And I don't think that's true with The Big Heat. I like The Big Heat's very on-the-ground approach. What I don't like is the sort of mainstream journalism that tries to look at this very wonkishly, and I don't think communicates the issue very well to the public. I think people can only understand these things when they really understand, look, all this wildlife is dying. And, you know, similar points that I think you guys really push out there. Could you sort of comment on that, the sort of approaches that people have taken?
Well, I mean, in a way, what we're doing, it's war reporting, right? It's environmental war reporting. It's not, you know, we're not on the ground in Afghanistan about, you know, military warfare necessarily, but it is war. It is a different sort of beast that we're dealing with. And, you know, I would compare it to war journalism in the sense that, yeah, we could look at, you know, the Pentagon's press releases of troop movements and the Trump's rationale for, you know, going after Venezuela or something like this. But what is it really doing? How are the people on the ground? What are they experiencing? You know, and that's sort of the lens that we try to shine here in the big heat, is what is this looking like on the ground to the communities that are being ravaged by wildfires or drought or those sorts of things? What does it look like? Not necessarily what does it look like on paper, but what does it look like through the eyes of the people that are experiencing it? And we really tried to go that route. I mean, and not only because, you know, we're journalists, we're not scientists, we do our best to crack open the corporate culture, but do it in a way that's palatable to people, and then as well as telling people stories, because that's really what this is all about.
And I think it's the stories that really are what persuade people to take these issues seriously.
Yeah, you know, and it transcends political boundaries. You know, I grew up in a very conservative community in Montana. I come from, you know, I didn't grow up on a farm, but both my parents were from farms. Most of my relatives are pretty conservative folks, socially at least, social values. But, you know, then when I talk to them and how they've experiencing climate change, they know it's very real. They know how the soil has changed. They know how the topography is changing. They know how drought is impacting their crops. And they're very open to talking about it. And you know what? They're the first ones to say that fossil fuel industry is largely to blame. And these are not people that, you know, are hanging banners from bridges protesting oil tankers. You know, these are, you know, your blue collar, folks. And, you know, I think that's I think it's a positive sign, that more and more people are waking up to the reality of what we're dealing with. And, I think more and more people are doing so. You know, a lot of people are not buying Trump's rhetoric a lot of the Republican rhetoric, especially, that this is totally fake and not happening at all. And if it is happening, it's not humans that are responsible. I think majority of people disagree with that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My father is actually, you know, he leans towards the sort of conservative or maybe sometimes libertarian side. But, you know, when it comes to his national parks, he loves national parks. He gets real angry with the conservatives. Or another thing he gets mad about is, you know, conservatives who think we should be able to hunt endangered species. He'll go crazy over that. And, you know, he takes this like left-wing turn. Whenever you mess with the animals or the environment, the national parks, that's when he gets mad. And I think that's true for a lot more people than we realize.
Yeah, certainly. I know. I think the bigger challenge is the next step, right? Which is, how are we going to motivate these people to act? And what does that action look like? Is it in the form of a Green New Deal, or is it in something more tangible, in the sense that is it them fighting things in their own backyard, whether it's oil development or this or that, right? Maybe it's just putting solar panels on your house. But it, you know, everybody acts in a different way. But it's how raising awareness is one thing, but then cultivating into action is another, and I think that's a big challenge.
Well, let's do some awareness raising here before we get into what the acts of resistance are. How would you describe the situation on the ground? Can you give some examples, maybe from the book, of what is going on and how wildlife and the environment is being just damaged right now?
Sure. In the sense of things that are happening, people acting, or in the sense of actions, or more of like impacts?
The impacts right now, what we're seeing happening, how the climate is changing, how the wildlife is being affected.
Sure. You know, we write about quite a few different instances. One that's pretty close to Jeff and I's heart is the buffalo in the Yellowstone Park area, and also grizzly bears in that area, the Montana, Wyoming area, especially the Yellowstone Park is the most biologically diverse area in the lower 48. It is home to literally hundreds of species that are threatened or endangered. And a lot of those animals, bison in particular, they aren't aware of the park's boundaries, right? They can roam outside of those park boundaries and they lose protection. And they fall under totally different jurisdictions no matter which state they're in and which boundaries they exit. And they are a endangered species that has been pushed to the brink because of human impact. There's no question about it. And that's one case where we try to sort of shine a spotlight on the plight of the wild bison in the Yellowstone area and how bureaucrats in Montana and Wyoming are dealing with them, and raising awareness, I think, hopefully for people that are there working on those issues, fighting those issues. There's a lot of groups that are doing really, really good work. I think grizzly bears is another one. I mean, grizzly bears in particular are fleeing certain areas that they are habitat in because of the changing climate. They are being forced to roam outside of their normal areas in search of food. Some of the trees that they eat after they come out of hibernation, some of the pine cones, those trees are dying. The warmer temperatures are allowing beetles to infest those trees, and their food source is being depleted. And they are very, very intelligent animals, and they leave their certain areas, and are when they do so, they're going in completely different territory that puts them at great risk. Those are two really good examples, I think, of how not only our corporate sort of bureaucracy and the government is dealing with them, but also how climate is impacting them as well. And then aside from animals, you know, we look at how wildfires are ravaging the West, and they're becoming more and more intense. And we look at how climate change is playing a role in that as well. The number of fires have not necessarily increased, but the number of acres burned has increased, and the ferocity of the fires has gotten worse, and largely because of climate change. Warmer temperatures, drier winters are fodder for hotter summers, which in turn allow these fires to burn. And you know, the impact of those fires on wildlife is very great, but also on the human toll of it as well. And not only that, but you know, of course, the tax burden for the taxpayer to mitigate those costs. So you know, those are a lot of different of the things that we try to look at in the book. And then, of course, outside of the U.S., we also try to shine a little light on how our U.S. military actions are impacting the planet. We look at how bombing of Afghanistan, for example, is threatening the endangered snow leopard there, and also how it's impacting migratory birds. We often talk about human casualties of war, but we often overlook what kind of impact bombing has on regions, and in large part because scientists have a very difficult time getting into areas to assess the damage done. And we often don't know really the impact for decades later. And of course, the war in Afghanistan is going on, 18, 19 years now. So we don't even really know the true impact. And munitions, of course, last a very long time. They can impact groundwater supplies for, you know, hundreds of years in some cases. So those impacts are very, very great. So we look at more than just the climate. We look at sort of all facets of how our planet is being wrecked.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask in particular about the Yellowstone stuff, because you have an article in there called "The Privatization of Wildlife, How Ted Turner Scored Yellowstone's Bison Herd." And I think it's interesting because it ties into the way that capitalism is in part responsible for a lot of this, you know, ravaging of the wildlife and the environment. Could you talk a little bit about that Ted Turner piece that you wrote?
Sure. Basically, Ted Turner, you know, he has a lot of clout. He has a lot of power. He owns, I think he's definitely the biggest private landowner in the state of Montana. And he basically struck a deal with the local agencies there to, quote unquote, help save the Yellowstone bison. But in turn, what he was doing was continuing. He was going to own them and use them to propagate so that they can fill his restaurants with buffalo meat. And of course, environmentalists had, it was a big outcry, but he did, was able to, I don't know the exact number, several hundred bison were able to basically be handed over to him directly for him to manage. And this is the privatization of wildlife, something that is totally unheard of and should be completely illegal. Those bison belong on the public lands and should never be privatized. You know, it sets a pretty dangerous precedent for other wildlife as well. But, you know, in Ted Turner's eyes, he's doing the right thing and they're a commodity. But to the rest of us, it looks like a pretty shady deal with the bison's best interest not at hand, not at the center of the deal. But essentially, the state government didn't want to deal with bison that are roaming on public lands, and they thought it was going to be easier to hand them over to a rich corporate tycoon. And that's what they did, with little to no oversight from the public, mind you. The public has not been able to go and check in on the health welfare of those bison. So, you know, all around, it was a completely shady deal, and Ted Turner got away with it.
Well, I think that's a good launching off point for a discussion of, you know, I think the sort of moderate, sort of liberal Democrats in this country think that we can deal with these issues through, you know, so-called green capitalism. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could just comment on this whole green capitalism thing and you know, the problems with it. I don't think it's going to work.
No, of course it's not. We can look at, for instance, the carbon offset market. On paper, in theory, yeah, it looks like it should help decline, you know, CO2 emissions. But really, what it's doing is allowing polluters to pay to continue to pollute. There's been a lot of studies, some in Canada, for example, that it hasn't mitigated CO2 or carbon emissions. In fact, most of the big polluters are polluting more than they did before some of these cap and trade policies were in place. And it's the same across this country as well. When you let the market dictate environmental policy, it's typically the ones with money that win, and those tend to be the fossil fuel industry folks. So, no, I don't think that the market can save us. I've never seen an example where capitalism in its current form, or any form for that matter, has saved a chunk of land or the environment for the benefit of the planet. Capitalism is based on largely on resource extraction. That's the backbone of our entire world market. And to dismantle that, to dismantle capitalism means to dismantle the fossil fuel industry first and foremost. And of course, you know, there's a lot of books written about this. But I would caution people to buy into the idea that the market can actually help protect the environment. There's just no evidence that it can or could ever happen.
Well, I mean, to me, and maybe I'm oversimplifying, to me, it's a matter of, you know, what is the market about? It's about, you know, increasing profits. I mean, the environment be damned in that case, right? You know.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. That's not. Well, look at the lobbyists that have the most power in Washington, and though even those that might be leaning towards the, you know, green energy, for example, they still don't want to decentralize the power grid. They don't want to give cities and communities the power to produce, or the power in the sense of the ability to put solar panels on their own roofs. I live in Southern California. I have solar on my roof, but I cannot have a battery as well. I have to be tied into the grid. I still have to pay for those hookup fees. And those big energy companies still have the power to do that. They do not want to lose that centralized power. So, you know, we can go into that, but it's a huge problem that those corporate bureaucracies continue to control our power system in this country. So even if we move towards green energy, for example, what does that mean? Does it mean that our deserts are going to be full of solar panels? What is that? What kind of impact will that have on the desert ecology? Windmills, for example, wind turbines, what kind of impact is that going to have on migratory birds, especially these huge wind farms? If power continues to be centralized, we're going to be continuing to go down the wrong road of mitigating the catastrophe we're in.
Yeah, it really is a catastrophe. And there's so many points in reading The Big Heat where I found my blood pressure going up. I felt like raging a little bit. One essay in particular was The Bloodstained Shores of Taiji, where you talk about the dolphin slaughter. Could you talk about that and how it relates back to the sort of issue of capitalism and why it really can't deal with these issues?
Sure. Well, in a small fishing village in Japan, they're traditionally they've been catching wild dolphins. Those dolphins, hundreds of years ago, they're very plentiful and they were a food source in some ways. Most of Japan does not support or eat dolphin meat, but this small community continues to practice the capturing of dolphins. And in doing so, it's not just for food, it's actually for sale. And they are selling these dolphins to marine entertainment parks all over the world. The SeaWorlds of the world, as an example, SeaWorld has purchased dolphins from this catch in Taiji. So some of the dolphins make it out and they have a horrible life entertaining and performing people living in tanks. You know, these are animals that once roamed free in the ocean as they should. And the next thing you know, they're being tanked in small containers across the ocean to, theme parks in Mexico and all over. And those are the ones that are lucky. The other ones are slaughtered. It's a sort of a pick and choose game. Organizations like Sea Shepherd are on the front lines raising awareness about this. They're also, in many ways, the only ones on the ground fighting it. There's a lot of history with them jumping into, the ocean, cutting nets, trying to free dolphins. There's been documentaries made. It's an example of how a wild species has been commodified for human entertainment and human pleasure. And the impact of that is pretty horrific. The sight of blood-stained waters from dolphins being killed, the ones that aren't going to be captured and taken away, is a pretty horrific thing. And that's not something that, the patrons of SeaWorld are getting handed when they get the flyer of that, that day's show events and what time they start at. They're also not going to see where those animals came from and really learn about what captivity does to these animals. It's a horrific thing. That's one gruesome example.
Well, I think it's horrific. And I also think people often miss the point that, tampering with wildlife like this and just pushing so many animals onto the endangered species list right into extinction, it's going to have ramifications for us and our ecosystem as well.
Oh, certainly. And I would caution people, we hold up the Endangered Species Act as sort of this holy grail. But really what it is, it's the last line of defense. And the numbers of species that scientists deem to be healthy, those are all human made, numbers. Those are not necessarily historical numbers, because some of those historical numbers can never be achieved again. So this is really what those numbers indicate, is that if they dip below that boundary, then those species may go extinct forever. And that's a hard thing, I think, to comprehend. If something's gone, it never will return in that form or in that state again. Certain things can be reintroduced, but the biological and genetic diversity of those species will never be replenished. And so it is a dire situation. It's a dire call to action, I think. And climate change is only making matters much, much worse.
Yeah, and I think, too, people forget how these things, affect human life, too. One of the things that always gets my blood boiling is the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. I mean, you have kids that are getting lead poisoning. They're damaged for life, you know, and people don't realize what that actually means. Like, they're screwed in a lot of ways. And I know you write about that in the book as well.
Yeah, Flint, Michigan, not much has changed since we were writing about it 2 years ago. The water there is still unsafe. Flint is just one city of many that is dealing with these issues. Portland, Oregon, for example.
We had a scare over here in Pittsburgh about a year or so ago, a lead water scare.
Yeah, a lot of the older buildings, and the ones we hear about are the ones that are publicly run. So in many cases, they're libraries or community centers or schools. In Portland, for example, and I'm sure it's the same in Pittsburgh, some of these buildings are very old, lead pipes. And these are drinking fountains that kids are drinking out of every day. And what does that impact, and what does that impact have over the long term on these kids' health? And of course, as we know, lead impacts kids that are growing a lot much more than certain people. So it's a dangerous thing. It's an infrastructure problem. And it's also a class problem, because most of the kids that are being impacted by this are lower income kids that are not, going to schools that are new. And of course, as we know, our public school system in this country is it's also on the brink in many ways. And the infrastructure of these buildings is the first to go. And then the teachers. These kids are getting, it's on all fronts that they're being impacted. And Flint, I think, was just one of the first smoke signals of how great this problem is all across the country.
Well, I think we've given some examples, some very good examples of the sort of decay we're seeing when it comes to the environment and wildlife. But I think the question that you guys pose a lot in the book is, how exactly did we get here? And a lot of people may be surprised by the answers. You do not let the Democratic Party off the hook for this. It's not just Trump, in other words.
Oh, certainly not. In many ways, of course, Obama was preferable to a current administration. Certainly, we weren't living through a daily tweet storm of chaos and mayhem and ridiculousness. But when it came to the fossil fuel industry, they were profiting under Obama just the same as they're profiting under Trump. We saw an increase of offshore drilling under Obama. Of course, Trump wants to expand that. We saw for the first time in decades an increase in natural gas production. And that was largely due to the fracking explosion, largely in Texas and other places, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, of course. And oil, fracked oil in the Bakken region of North Dakota. We're actually exporting oil for the first time in decades, natural gas as well. So while we might have been talking tough about, combating climate change and joining climate change agreements in the Paris Accord and this and that, out of the other side of Obama's mouth and his policies were quite the opposite. We were actually a booming fossil fuel economy. And instead of maybe burning a lot of that fossil fuel here, we are shipping it to other countries to burn, parts of Asia and elsewhere. And the same goes for coal. We were stopped in large respects. Coal is a dying commodity in the U.S., but we started shipping coal off to other parts of the world because we weren't burning it anymore, and we were switching a lot of our coal plants to natural gas. So, you could go down the list. Obama knew, I think, what impact climate change was having. But he did not take on the fossil fuel industry and was certainly not an environmental savior that he many still claim he was.
Yeah, and I think, too, a lot of people focus on how the Republicans and the Trump administration sort of are seeking to deconstruct the federal government, the apparatus of it, and, you know, going after things like the EPA. But as the Big Heat points out, this was going on under Obama as well. There were attempts to sort of defang the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Could you talk a little bit about the EPA and how, you know, there's been a bipartisan attack on it?
Sure. Just go back to the BP oil spill that happened. Guess who was left off of the team that was going to work on that disaster? Lisa Jackson, who was the head of the EPA at the time. She was ready to hold BP accountable. She wanted them to pay for the cleanup. They wanted to oversee it. They wanted to take control of it. Obama didn't want it. He was getting pushed back from the fossil fuel industry. She was removed from that committee. Later, she was removed entirely from her position, forced out, I would say. So that's a perfect example of how, you know, the fossil fuel industry basically pushed the EPA out. And to this day, you know, right now we have an all-out war on the Environmental Protection Agency. Trump has slashed funding for scientists. There's stacks and stacks of reports that are never going to be finished. The EPA has essentially been gutted from the inside out. So whatever Obama did to punch them in the gut, Trump's knocked them out entirely. And this predates Obama, of course. It goes through the Bush administration and all the way back to the Clinton administration as well.
Can I comment on that real quick? I noticed Jeffrey St. Clair has a very interesting essay in the book called Paper Trails, Big Timber, the Clintons, and the Origins of the Whitewater Scandal. I have not heard about Whitewater in years. But yeah, it goes all the way back to the Clintons, if you could speak a little to that.
Sure. I cut my teeth in Oregon forest protests in the late 90s, early 2000s. That's sort of when I had my awakening, if it were. And that was Clinton time. Those were policies that Clinton had enacted. The old growth forests of the Northwest in California, redwood forests in particular, were being ravaged. And it was largely a deal that was struck by the Clinton administration. And the salvage rider, which was one of the things slipped into this legislation that allowed these timber companies to go in and essentially clear cut old growth forests. This was a liberal administration. The vice president had written a book about climate change, over a decade before that, knew the impacts and really was one of the first people in Congress to call attention to it on a big stage. But we had Clinton that was completely devastating our public lands and our forests, and those impacts were very great. And so seeing those impacts firsthand for me was an eye opener that this was a liberal Democratic administration that was selling us out. And of course, we expect that from the Republicans, but we don't always expect that from Democrats, or at least I didn't at the time, and I can tell you that I sure have changed my tune since then.
Well, I think ground zero for a lot of this, you really have to reach back in time to the 1980s. I always tell people this, and the 70s to an extent too, where you see the rise of this ideology called the Third Way and sort of neoliberalism, which I think is a term that gets thrown around a lot, but I'm not sure people completely understand it. Could you sort of elaborate on how neoliberalism relates to all of this, this change in how Democrats deal with things, and how it has sort of affected the discourse on climate change and environmentalism?
Sure. I mean, you can't really talk about neoliberalism without talking about capitalism. The modification of liberalism is basically into neoliberalism is a total acceptance of the free market and an elimination of regulations. So when you eliminate regulations, when we're talking about environmental issues, what that means is scaling back pollution requirements, a neoliberal approach to climate change, for example, would be cap and trade. They don't want regulations. They want to let the market dictate the environmental policy. So yeah, we often talk about neoliberalism in the sense that it's sort of laissez-faire economics. But when it comes to regulations and things that we really need to be put in place, neoliberal Democrats are, are our enemies. And there's no question about it. They don't want stricter air controls, pollution requirements, for example. They don't want stricter water quality requirements. They want to open up those markets. And, it definitely predates Clinton, but Clinton was the first to truly embody it. Obviously, in the White House, at least as a Democrat, and of course, those trade policies, the neoliberal trade policies, had horrific impacts on the environment. The NAFTA, for example, and this is one way some of us agree with Trump in some ways when he was talking about NAFTA. Not only did it sell out the American worker, but it sold and undermined current environmental policies. You had corporations in this country that had to abide by our regulations that could simply move to other countries that have weaker environmental regulations and set up shop to basically undercut our current, regulatory system. And that happened on a grand scale. It didn't just happen through NAFTA. It's happened and it's continuing to happen to this day. And it's regulated by the World Trade Organization. For instance, it's not just, worker rights and worker protections, which are obviously very important. But companies are setting up shop in India and Pakistan and China, of course, and Southeast Asia, into countries that do not abide by some of the same environmental regulations we do. And the corporations that are setting up shop there then don't have to, hold those. They're not held to the same requirements they would be if they were, setting up shop in Kansas, for example. So, it's a horrible system, and the neoliberal economic model is largely put us where we are today.
Well, it's also just a very bizarre sort of ideology. I mean, especially to me, I neoliberals will often have this mantra of, they talk about the social good, but they say the social good can be better provided for by private industry. The state isn't good for that. The state isn't good for that. And I just think to myself, how is that? That makes no sense to me. It's a bait and switch.
Yeah, I think that it is. And I think the neoliberals are very good at pointing out, certain things to, maybe push people towards voting for a Democrat over a Republican. But where's the alternative, right? It's in a sense, even the Republicans today are economically neoliberals as well. They might not be socially liberal, but when it comes to the market, they definitely are. And we've seen a consistent erosion of environmental policy and environment regulation in this country, and it predates Trump and goes back to the Carter administration. And it has a lot to do with the breaking down of unions. It has a lot to do with the opening up of markets. And where we are today is a manifestation of all of those things.
Well, I think the most interesting aspect of the book is there is still a lot of hopefulness in what you write about. You and Jeffrey both say, don't become a nihilist about this. Why do you take that approach? Because I see a lot of people being doom and gloom. It's the end of the world as we know it. Why do you guys think that, there is something still worth fighting for in all of this?
Well, Jeff and I both love to get out in nature, explore. We're also adherents and admirers of the great Ed Abbey. And Edward Abbey was a proponent of enjoying what we're fighting for while we still continue to fight for it and to have a good time doing it, because that's what life's all about. For me, I think I look at, for instance, the plight of the grizzly bear, wild salmon, and the things that are dear to me, and I know that they're still worth fighting for. I get out into the ocean often. I go and explore the desert. I like to backpack. I go out and explore these areas, and I know there's so much worth continuing to fight for and protect. And then I'm also inspired by the actions, for example, at Standing Rock, which I think was the best upheaval against the fossil fuel giants that we've seen in my lifetime. And I'm definitely inspired by that. I think that that's a call to action. I think it was empowering to see indigenous communities all over the world come to the defense of the people in North Dakota and the people fighting that. And so I look at these instances and I know that there's plenty to be depressed about. But I look at the opposite, you know, I look at what there's plenty to be excited about, and there's plenty to be excited and worth fighting for. You know, I don't think we should turn our backs on the people of Flint, Michigan, just because it's, you know, a difficult, you know, trudge. I think we should be on the front lines in every community that we're in to fight back. And I think there's plenty to fight for, you know, and as the climate warms and the ecology of the climate and weather patterns change, that doesn't necessarily mean humans are going to be gone overnight. We're going to have to be out there fighting for those less fortunate than us in all the countries. And of course, the impacts of our climate changing are going to impact the poor much more than the wealthy. And so I think on a different level, this is, as someone that comes from the left, I think this is the new class war will be largely fueled by climate catastrophe. And I think we're seeing it now. And that also to me is empowering and something to be motivating in our fighting back. Is we're not fighting just for wildlife and public lands. We're going to be fighting for the lives and communities of the poor people among us.
Could you maybe elaborate on that a little bit? I think that aspect of all of this really gets lost in the shuffle sometimes, how this is the new class warfare, this environmental struggle that we see ourselves in. It's going to pit the rich and the poor against each other in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know, and Mike Davis writes about this quite a bit. A perfect example was the forest fires in California this last fall, late summer. We had fires down here in Southern California, in Malibu. We saw these stories of, I think it was Kanye West and the Kardashians had a private fire department come and save their mansion. But meanwhile, in the Paradise fire up in Northern California, the people up there largely are older. They were on fixed incomes. And the impact that fire had on their community was far more devastating than the fire had on the Malibu community, not only because of the intensity of the fire, but largely because people weren't wealthy. They didn't have a means to get out. And then after the fire and after their properties have been destroyed, they don't have anywhere to go. They don't have, you know, the luxury of going to stay at a five-star hotel in the Bahamas after their home burned down. That's a perfect example, I think, of how these things that are being fueled by climate change are impacting people in different ways. The people that have a lot of resources are going to fare better than the people that don't. And that's not just in the U.S. It's going to be globally. We're seeing it in some of the islands that are, you know, being inundated with rising waters. The communities that have a lot of money are being able to build big walls, and the other communities that don't are going to be underwater, and they're going to lose their livelihoods and their land. So it's going to be massive. It's going to be intense. We can look at Syria, for example. A lot of things fueled the war in Syria, but at the heart of a lot of the early struggle for farmers in rural areas was the tremendous drought that they had been dealing with. Suicide rates among Indian farmers in India that have been struggling to survive under the weight of the drought for going on decades. The toll is taking on those communities is horrific, and it's all linked to climate change. So yeah, you know, the stories are endless, but there's just no question that those, the poor among us, are the ones that are going to suffer the most.
Well, I think we even see that the people versus the 1% in the aforementioned Standing Rock, Dakota mm-hmm. Access Pipeline protests. There's been so much misinformation by the sort of right-wing noise machine in this country about those protests. What was really at stake in the Standing Rock situation?
Well, I think what was at stake was pride, and I think what was at stake was land rights, and being able to dictate what can and cannot happen on, in this case, native lands. And a lot of the people that I talked to that were fighting that pipeline weren't all opposed to it being rerouted. They weren't necessarily opposed to that. They didn't want it coming through and harming their aquifer. So, you know, there was, of course, a lot of people that wanted it stopped altogether. But at the heart of it was about land rights and being able to dictate what can and cannot happen on, in this case, native lands. And I would argue, you know, it's going on in public lands. We have the current administration is attempting to open up ANWR, attempting to open up, you know, a lot of our national monuments to oil and gas extraction. And it's the same idea, but in the case it's not native land, it's public lands that are owned by you and me, and have little oversight. And essentially our lands are being sold to in some cases the lowest bidder, pennies on the dollar. And that's, you know, that I think when it comes down to it is what we're really fighting for is how are our lands going to be managed in the future. And I think Standing Rock was the heart of what Standing Rock was about.
Not just our lands, but also our waters. I mean, we're seeing sure. the mass destruction of the coral reefs.
Yeah, we are. And I wish I had an answer. You know, I wish it was just start using a different sunscreen, right? Because sunscreens are impacting our coral reefs in Australia and other places. But it's way greater than that. Our oceans are warming, and how do we turn that back? And maybe we don't. But the impact that coral dying is we have no idea what that impact is really going to be. We have no impact. We have no idea what the real impact of the bee population dying is going to be. We have models. We know what it might do. We know they're dying. In large part, we know why they're dying. But what are we going to do to stop that? You know, and yeah, I guess when I talk about land, water is absolutely integral in that.
Well, you know, it's a difficult situation because I think the situation we're in with climate change and the environment and wildlife is one that there isn't necessarily a you know, super great happy outcome. You know, it seems like we have a choice between, you know, saving what we can and just, you know, it's either that or let the whole thing burn, which, you know, I think is the worst possible outcome. I wanted to ask you, though, about, you mentioned Edward Abbey. I have a lot of younger millennial listeners that may not be familiar with Edward Abbey and the Monkey Wrench Gang. Could you speak a little bit about him? He's a really inspirational figure.
Absolutely. I mean, aside from the Monkey Wrench Gang, which is his most notable, you know, popular works.
It's a classic.
It's a classic novel about a band of misfits that take direct action into their own hands to fight back in the Southwest region of the U.S. And it's a great novel, and I'd recommend everybody pick it up. But I'd also, before you even start with that, I'd pick up Edward Abbey's Desert Solitaire. It's right up there with Thoreau, I would argue, and Leopold, Sand County Almanac. Edward Abbey's Desert Solitaire is a book of, it's nonfiction with multiple different books as well in it. It's multiple essays, and I would say. For me, it is the philosophical backbone and grounding philosophy behind the modern environmental movement. And it will give you a sense of history of the time he was writing about what he was seeing happen to the desert Southwest. And a lot of the things that he predicted came true and are coming true today. So if there's any book to pick up, I would say Desert Solitaire. But of course, The Monkey Wrench Gang is it's a fun read, and it's one that I think we should all revisit to inspire us to continue acting.
You know, the last thing I sort of wanted to touch upon was something we sort of got into with the Standing Rock protests, but the acts of resistance we can take. I think there's a lot of debate about what we do. There's people that talk about direct action. There's mm-hmm. people that are saying support the Green New Deal. You know, mm-hmm. we have all different kinds of outlooks on this. What is your take, though, on, you know, means of resistance?
You know, I get a lot of shit for this. I think, obviously, the more people that are involved in direct action, the better. Yes, I think we should dismantle capitalism. But that's easier said than done. And so in many ways, subverting capitalism is, I think, a very powerful tool. And how do we subvert capitalism? You know, not all of us can go to the front lines in Standing Rock and fight back. But most of us can find a farmer's market in our communities to go purchase goods. We can think twice about buying things from, you know, Walmart and other stores. And in doing so, thinking about the impact that might be having on the environment, everything has a carbon footprint attached to it. So if we can really rethink the way that we our communities function and do so in a way that has the least impact on the environment, the better. And if we can support local farmers, all the better. You know, I was having this conversation recently with someone. I would rather buy an orange that was grown 10 miles from here that might have some residual pesticides on it than an organic produce from Chile or South America. Because the impact ultimately would be far greater to have organic produce shipped to me from 2,000 miles away than something that's 10 miles away. You know, those are compromises we have to make, but I think thinking about things in a local way is a really, really great place to start. And then if you can get involved, you know, in your local governments, we need more bike-friendly cities. We need to get people out of their automobiles. You know, of course, I would love to do away with, you know, our car culture altogether. But how do we do that? We make it the least attractive alternative. And we do that by getting back out on the streets, walking, biking. You know, those are things on the local level I think people can do that are very tangible. And then from there, you know, educating ourselves about where our power is coming from. Depending on what state you live in, where is that power being generated? Is it being generated by coal plants? Is it being generated by natural gas? How can you fight back? How can you try to push for more green energies? You know, so there's multiple ways we can do that. Of course, like I said, I'd love to radicalize everybody and overthrow capitalism and live on, you know, socialist utopia that's powered by green energy. But we're not going to get there overnight. And how do we move in that direction? And so those are, I think, some baby steps.
Well, you know, people like to argue about the direct action stuff, and I always liked the quote by Utah Phillips. The earth is not dying. It is being killed, and those who are killing it have names and addresses, which it's a really, you know, that's off-putting to a lot of people to say that. But it does hammer home the point that, you know, regardless of what you think of direct action, the people that are harming the environment, these people are criminals. You know, what they're doing is criminal.
Absolutely, and they should be held accountable. And, you know, and it's not just the people that are running these corporations, it's their allies in Washington as well that are criminals. So yeah, we definitely need to hold them accountable. But you know, of course, that's also easier said than done, right? if you and I go attempt to arrest the CEO of ExxonMobil, we'll probably not get very far. but yeah, we need to call them out as the criminals that they are, and in the banks that support them, and push for the defunding of fossil fuels. You know, that means pressuring Bank of America and other others, Citibank and others, to stop getting loans to dirty fossil fuel providers. So on multiple fronts, we can fight back. There's no question.
And I guess on that front of resistance, too, there's also a lot of debate about whether lifestyle changes really are effective in dealing with these issues. What is your take on that, out of curiosity?
Well, I don't think that they alone can alter the fate of the planet. I think it's one piece of a puzzle. And I don't think any one of these things we're talking about should be done in isolation. I think that it's certainly not an answer, but I am a proponent of eating less meat. I think the more people that eat less meat, the better our planet will be. Am I kidding myself to think that if me and 12 of my friends stop eating meat that we're saving the planet? No, but raising that awareness is, I think, a good thing. But it shouldn't happen in isolation. And likewise, I don't think that people on the front lines fighting the fossil fuel industry should be shopping at Walmart. You know, I mean,
there's multiple fronts to fight the war.
Yeah, absolutely. There's multiple fronts to fight. It's a big puzzle with lots of pieces. And I think we all have a role in that. And there's things that we can all do. It's going to be easier, for example, probably to talk your dad into thinking going to the farmer's market than going to the front lines in a protest, right? And so we also have to be reasonable about what we're asking people to do. But in the same sense, we have to keep pushing them too. And we've had this conversation with the Green New Deal that's been proposed. By no means is it calling for the overthrow of capitalism. I don't think it goes nearly far enough. But what it does do is it calls for an end of the fossil fuel industry in this country. And that in and of itself is a huge step forward. Is it the end all? Absolutely not. And I think those of us on the left should continue to push for more radical change. But the fact that the Green New Deal has made it into mainstream discourse is a testament to the fact that what we've been doing and saying for all these years is kind of starting to catch on. And so that's a positive note.
Well, you know, I wanted to ask in relation to the Green New Deal, we're seeing sort of the rise of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Mm-hmm. And also now Bernie has announced he is running in the 2020 election. What is your thoughts on that? Because I know a lot of people on the left are like, well, these people aren't radical enough. They're democratic socialists or social democrats. That's not what we want. We need more radical than that. What is your take? Because I think we can be nuanced about it.
Certainly. I'm a proponent of third parties. I think that we need more voices and more choices in our electoral system, especially at the local levels. What inspires me, I think, about Bernie isn't Bernie himself, but it's the movement and excitement that he's cultivated. And I think that the younger generation is the generation that's going to lead us forward. And by and large, the progressives that are part of the Bernie movement are pretty inspirational. And I don't think they have it all right, but I think it's a great start. And I think they're providing more than most are. I would say, you know, vote green when you can. But I'm excited by those folks. And I think that more and more people aren't afraid to say that they're on the left. I think more and more people are not afraid to say that they're socialists. And, you know, whatever you might think about Bernie, Bernie's largely, you know, to be, you know, he's the one that's, he's the one that's allowed that to happen. I can be cynical, but I think ultimately it's kind of hopeful. Now, is he the right candidate? I don't know. But I'm excited by the movement that he's cultivated. My fear is the same thing that happened in the last election, which was if Bernie doesn't rise to the forefront and win, or another progressive, Elizabeth Warren or somebody else, rise to win. We can argue if he's progressive or not. That's a different issue. But if someone else doesn't rise up from the left and we have another corporate Democrat taking on Trump in 2020, will Bernie call for his followers to support that candidate? And I think that's very dangerous, because in that sense, all he's doing is cultivating more progressives into a very conservative Democratic Party, and that's not what we need. I think it'd be much more empowering if instead he said, support the issues that you believe in, and if that means breaking from the Democratic Party, please do so. So that would be my only caveat and fear, is that we would have a replay of 2016 in that sense.
Well, you know, I like the term that Jeffrey St. Clair has been using, the Sandernistas. To me, it's what's important about all of this is the energy of that movement.
Right.
And these young people today, they know that in a lot of ways they've been sold down the river. And, you know, I
yep.
think if they can take that anger and take that sense of injustice and push it into something productive, you know, I think that can do a lot of good. It's all about the energy.
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that if you would have told me we'd have gay marriage in this country, that we would have legalized marijuana in many states, that we would be having a Green New Deal being debated on Fox News, that we would have Medicare for All being a rallying cry of a good portion of the population, I would have said you're full of shit. So, you know, I'm happy of where we're at in some cases. You know, I think that we can get pretty fucking depressed about where we're at with Trump.
Not just Trump. We're seeing the... Sure. The rise of right wing, if not fascism, then proto-fascism. I mean, Bolsonaro in Brazil, all of these figures are rising up, and it's a dangerous situation.
Yes, it is. And the neo-fascist movement has been empowered by all of this as well. And I think, and that shouldn't be understated. And I think that's a main reason more and more people should be active in that on that front. But I will say that, in lieu of all of that, we're still moving in many ways in progressive, you know, in toward a progressive future. And I think the pendulum swings. And the reason that the white nationalist movement, for instance, in this country has been empowered is largely because they're afraid of us. They're afraid of a multi-ethnic, class-oriented, progressive, radical struggle. And that's their reaction to it is a violent one, and we're winning. And I think they're very, very frightened about that. So that I think can't be understated as well. You know, and I would also argue that, you know, we live in this era, of fear, and that's not a new thing. Our fear is being cultivated. You know, Trump is trying to cultivate fear. Largely, the white nationalist and fascist, you know, fascist movements are rallying around fear. Fear mongering is everywhere. And I think a lot of people can get pretty afraid of climate catastrophe and what's happening with our climate. And I think instead of being afraid, let's manifest that into energy to fight back. And instead of being afraid of what we aren't in control of, let's take control of what we can, you know, can do, and what is tangible and what's right in front of us. And so if that is, like we were talking about, very simply something that we might be purchasing, or more importantly, if there are right-wing groups and movements in your hometowns, fighting them back and going to counter protests, and being seen, those they're outnumbered by many fold, and that I think also can't be understated, and we shouldn't be afraid to stick our necks out.
Well, it's that famous quote from Dune, right? Fear is the mind killer.
Yeah, it is, and fear is the death knell of many movements as well. And I think let's not let that be, you know, the end game for environmentalism. Let's not let it be the end game for the Sanders movement. Let's not be afraid to stick up for our ideals and what we believe is right, because the more of us that stand up, the sooner, you know, the pendulum will swing back in our direction.
Are there any, you know, maybe there's a, I think we've been getting on a positive note. That's how I usually like to end the show. But if there's anything else you would like to say, or maybe talk a little bit about Counterpunch and promote any of the books you guys have been coming out with.
Sure. You know, of course, I'd love for you guys to pick up a copy of The Big Heat. You can go to to Amazon if that's your fancy. We prefer, obviously, that you go to counterpunch.org and purchase it directly from us. You might have a nice independent local bookstore. If they don't carry it, they can certainly get it. And counterpunch.org is a radical online newsletter. We update the site 5 times a week. We also have a print magazine that is out bi-monthly. It's a pretty cool magazine, I have to say. It's about 40 pages long. Really interesting stuff. We've got everything from, you know, columns to investigative reporting to culture and movie reviews. I think it's a pretty neat deal. And you know, print is dying. We're published on recycled paper, so don't be worried about that. And it is it's a dying medium, and I'm happy that we still have a print edition, at least for now. So people can also go in and sign up for that. But, you know, Counterpunch is free to all. So come by, read daily, share articles, disagree with us. Counterpunch is sort of a place to come. We're a family of sorts that we might have a couple angry uncles at the dinner table, and we all get into little food fights now and then. But that's what makes it kind of fun. You're going to likely come and find things you agree with and things that you don't agree with. And hopefully in the end, you know, be engaged. And that's what we hope to do.
And you also got Counterpunch Radio, which I highly recommend, Eric Dreitzer. I wanted to say real quick, and then I'll let you go, on that comment about, you know, where to buy the book from. Please, folks, buy it from Counterpunch. Amazon, we kicked their butt in New York recently. Let's keep doing that, because, you know, they're the big bad wolf in a lot of ways. Buy from local bookstores, buy from Counterpunch, get the book, The Big Heat.
Yeah, please do. Thanks so much.
It's over, Johnny. It's over!
Nothing is over! Nothing! You just don't turn it off! It wasn't my war!
That may be true, Rambo, but... Well, yes, as a matter of fact, that is exactly what I was going to say, Trent Reznor. Now that's the kind of spirit I'm talking about. Folks, be sure to check out The Big Heat, Earth on the Brink, by Jeffrey St. Clair and Joshua Frank, out now from Counterpunch. Be sure to check out Counterpunch. It's updated 5 days a week. You'll get some of the best news and analysis from a left-wing perspective at counterpunch.org. That's counterpunch.org. And if you can, please like, share, comment, get the word out there about this episode. And also, if you are feeling generous, please consider donating to the Parallax Views Patreon page. It's you, the listener, that allows this show to keep going. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.